This is a conversation with academic and activist Luckman Tsui on the loss of press freedom in Hong Kong. We discuss Luckman's history as an academic, teaching the next generation of journalists in Hong Kong the values of journalistic theory and press freedom, how his life as an academic changed as China sought to crack down on the Hong Kong protests and freedom of expression in Hong Kong's media, what the consequences for Hong Kong's media have been post the national security law, and what the future of media and press freedom may be for Hong Kong. It's an important conversation with a subject who's thought deeply on these issues and their global importance. For more conversations like this, you can go to our back catalog on the Arts of Travel podcast. And for print interviews on Hong Kong, you can go to our webpage, asiaarttours.com. Here's my conversation now with academic and activist Luckman Tsui on the loss of press freedom in Hong Kong.
My name is Luckman Tsui. I was born and raised in Amsterdam, and I'm back in Amsterdam now. But for the last, I was in Hong Kong since 2010 until recently. First to teach at City University of Hong Kong, and then I worked for Google as the head of free expression in Asia and the Pacific. And then in 2014, I decided to move from Google to the Chinese University of Hong Kong, and I've taught there since until last year. And I was a professor there at the School of Journalism. And right now I'm a fellow with the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto, and I'm trying to working on a personal book project.
So there's a lot of outstanding writers and journalists who've been introduced to a more global audience. Mary Hui, Xinqi Su, Chris Cheung, Tim McLaughlin, Wilfred Chen. I could go on and on. But their coverage is typically about the contemporary situation in Hong Kong because it changes so much day to day. I'm wondering, before we get into the day to day, could you talk a little bit about Hong Kong's media history and how it was able to develop what until recently was a free press that is radically different from how journalism is practiced in mainland China?
When we talk about the media history of Hong Kong, we talk about the history of Hong Kong more in general too. Those are sort of really linked. And so you ask, why has Hong Kong been able to develop a free press that was so different, or that was so different from the one in China? And the simple answer is one country, two systems. And that was an agreement between the UK and China in the early 1980s. Hong Kong was a crown colony from the UK between 1841 and until 1997, when they handed it back to China. And in that agreement was stipulated the principle of one country, two systems, meaning, Hong Kong, it would be all one country, Hong Kong, China, and so on. But it would consist of two separate systems. And so China would have its system and Hong Kong would have its own system. That meant its own political system, its own legal system, and also its own media and press system. And so what I think the longer answer is sort of that it's important to note that the Communist Party back then in the 80s isn't the same as the one today. Back then, Deng Xiaoping, was in charge, and Deng Xiaoping was, I think, a little bit more open-minded than Xi is right now. They experimented with different things. He was more pragmatic. He was open to trying new things. And in addition, the relationship between Hong Kong and China back then was also very, very different. And so the economic reality is that in Hong Kong, that Hong Kong used to be a massive part of China's GDP. I think back in the late 90s, it was around 18%. So that's almost one fifth of the entire Chinese economy. And that was right after the handover. And at the moment, it's, you know, depending on who you ask, 2 or 3%. So the UK had an incentive to not just hand, you know, at the time, 5 million people back to an authoritarian regime, and wanted to look good, right? And so the UK made some, you know, made China promise a couple of things, including sort of a transition to universal suffrage and so on for Hong Kong after it would go back to China. And China at the time, Beijing at the time, was interested in not slaying the goose that was laying the golden eggs, basically. You know, like Hong Kong at the time was a massive part of China's economy, almost 20%. And so at the time, you know, Hong Kong, you know, they didn't want to touch Hong Kong too much. And that is now very, very different, obviously. And so, you know, that's sort of the longer answer for why Hong Kong has been able to develop the robust and free and independent press system that it had until, you know, quite recently. Obviously, I know it has changed a lot in the last 2 years. But this is how Hong Kong ended up with a media ecology super diverse and super robust, ranging from state-funded media like Dan Gongbao and Wen Huibao, you know, who get their money straight from Beijing, to more centrist media like Mingbao, and even to broadcasters like Radio Television Hong Kong that follow a much more sort of European model of broadcasting, you know, where they try to serve, quote unquote, the public interest, to an Apple Daily that is now, of course, shut down, but an Apple Daily that is much more sort of following the American model of, you know, commercial commercialism, right? Trying to sell as many papers as possible, trying to make money as much as possible. And so that's how Hong Kong ended up with this very rich and diverse and a strong media ecology. And that, of course, changed in the last few years.
So you've spoken eloquently in a few interviews on media in general. A figure that stands out is Alvin Au and institutions like Stan News. I do not have a good understanding of sort of the censorship model quite yet. The publications of you sort of have discussed have been so diverse, the ones that have been targeted, that it's hard to sort of envision just one red line, but rather it should be thought of as red lines. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit now, in Hong Kong, do outlets have a better sense of what the red lines are, or is it still a very nebulous time where it seems like just the emotionality of a bureaucrat, or if someone in LegCo is having a bad day, it could mean the shutting down of a media institution?
There is no clear red line, and that is by design, because what they want to do is they want to foster this culture of self-censorship. And so if they keep you guessing, then, you know, you need to play it safe. And then you constantly just err on the side of caution, and so that's not just, and that makes it really, really difficult to practice journalism, of course. And it resulted in the shutdown of Citizen News. You know, following the, you know, the arrest and the shutdown of Stan News, Citizen News, you know, and they're both online media, online news outlets, right, that came into being, you know, after the Umbrella Movement in Hong Kong. And these online news outlets, Citizen News, saw what happened to Stan News. And the editors there basically said, you know, we have no idea. We can no longer tell what is okay and what's not okay. And so that means that we no longer can protect our staff, our reporters. And so we don't know what we will publish that will get us on the safe side versus, you know, that will keep get us into trouble. And so Citizen News following Stan News saying, you know, like, it's not that different, you know, like what we do compared to Stan News, right? And then so they said, you know, if Stan News can be shut down like that, then maybe it's safe for us to shut down too, because we just cannot guarantee the safety of our staff anymore. And so right now, that red line is very much invisible almost, you know, it's sort of like infrared lines. I don't expect that to last forever. But right now, it's a transitional phase. We have to endure the storm. And at some point, it will crystallize a little bit more. But right now, it's very, very unclear what the red lines are, you know. And this started ever since national security law came into being in 2020, you know. And on paper, there are four crimes, right? Collusion, foreign forces, secession, subversion, and what's the last one that I'm forgetting? But while it seems to be sort of clear on paper, the reality shows that the government and the authorities and the police, they can charge anything they don't like. And so what we have seen is that, and this goes a little bit more than beyond sort of journalism, but we have seen children's pictures book being charged under the national security law because they depict stories that involve lambs and wolves, you know, and you could read it allegorically, you know, as a criticism on the government or the police. We've seen shops no longer carrying water bottles because they carried a sticker that said Hong Kong and oil, you know, which is sort of a basic slogan, you know, that's, you know, like that says sort of, hey, you know, come on, Hong Kong. But they argue that it could be seen as sort of being in support of, you know, protesters and so on. We've seen lighting a candle, you know, especially on June 4th, now being considered subversive and so on. And so it really is hard to tell at this point what could or could not be crossing the red line. And in the case of Stan News, what we've seen also is that even things that were considered okay in the past, retroactively can be applied in the future and not be okay. And so it's hard to say what's okay now. And even if it's okay now, that doesn't mean that it's going to be okay in the future. And so that's sort of what the situation in Hong Kong right now, which makes, you know, the basic reporting really, really challenging and difficult, to put it mildly.
Media, for better or worse, oftentimes focuses on a Jeff Bezos or Jimmy Lai more than it does what figures like Jack London or George Orwell or Upton Sinclair would do, which is sort of reporting from those excluded from the benefits of a country's economy, which unfortunately is more and more of the global population in this era of billionaires. A lot of attention has been paid to figures like Jimmy Lai. I'm wondering if you could discuss a little bit, for ordinary journalists, how has this campaign of censorship and draconian arrests, how has that impacted what I imagine was a fairly important part of Hong Kong's economy? And do you have a sense of when these prosecutions happen, are people being prosecuted as harshly as Jimmy Lai, but because they're not as famous, they're having to endure this carceral violence without any press attention being paid to them? So what's the scope and scale that this campaign of repression has had on Hong Kong's economy? And what are some of the consequences that ordinary journalists are having to endure that maybe are being underreported?
So yeah, Apple Daily and Jimmy Lai got most of the attention, you know, and that's because it's such a great, great, I put that sort of sarcastic, but, you know, such a sexy media story, right? You know, like headquarters being raided, assets being frozen, you know, Jimmy Lai, you know, like super outspoken and charismatic, right? And there are some other stories that are, as you, you know, suggest, are being underreported and that are just as influential or even more impactful. And I'm thinking here of, something that, that what happened to Radio Television Hong Kong, the public service broadcaster, that is still around. But so it didn't die, it wasn't killed like Apple Daily was, but I would argue it suffered a fate worse than Apple Daily. Apple Daily had the dignity of death, and Radio Television Hong Kong is forced to continue to live on, but kind of like a zombie at this point, meaning it sort of looks like Radio Television Hong Kong, it acts like Radio Television Hong Kong, but it's completely different, sort of soulless news organization now. And that's really, really amazing and sad how fast they were able to degrade and change Radio Television Hong Kong, which was the most respected public service broadcaster in Hong Kong. I think it was the first one. And it made really influential and important, programs and documentaries. One very famous program was Hong Kong Connection. This is the program, long form documentary investigative that all my students wanted to work for, basically. What they did to Radio Television Hong Kong was they installed a bureaucrat with no journalistic background as the head. His job was purely to butcher the organization and without shame to do so in broad daylight. So what happened to Radio Television Hong Kong, just to sort of give you a couple of examples. For example, there was a very famous program called Headliner. And this was like a satire program. And with a long, long, long history, so like it started, I think, in 1989, and it got ended in 2020 because it made fun of the police, basically, and this is sort of to simplify it a lot, but they made, satire, political commentary, and one episode particularly was sort of just making fun of the police, and the police, thought it was insulting and even inciting hatred. And the entire program got into trouble for that and eventually was shut down because of that. And this is, as I said, a really long running program that had with a long history that people watched all the time. There was the case of Bao Choi, a journalist with Radio Television Hong Kong. And what happened to her was also, I think illustrating. She was investigating the July 21st Julong attacks. And these are attacks that happened in 2019 when the Hong Kong protests were going on. And it was a particularly bad night because basically Triad members were attacking protesters in an area called Yuen Long in Hong Kong. The Triad were wearing white shirts and beating up all the protesters. And that wasn't why it was so bad. That was bad enough, but what made it worse was that the police were repeatedly called and they stood by and did nothing. And some would even argue that they were colluding, although, I don't know exactly the details of that. But basically, this is a hugely controversial event. And Bao Choi, this reporter from Radio Television Hong Kong, was trying to, of course, look into this, right? What was happening? What actually happened? Because the police was denying everything. But Stan News, this news online news organization, was streaming everything, so we could all watch it for ourselves. And the images were really, really shocking. And Bao Choi was trying to look into this, trying to figure out the timeline of events, what happened first, what happened then, what happened after. And as part of her investigative research, she was trying to trace license plates of police cars. And this is a government registry that you can use to do so, right? And in the past, you can make use of the government registry, and then you have to check, you have to tell them the reason you're using this registry for. And in the past, you could check off a box that said media. Now that checkbox was gone. they changed that because they, you know, the government has actually been on, there have been ongoing development to become less transparent. And this is part of that. But so the checkbox for media was gone. And so she, instead she checked off the checkbox that said other traffic and transport related matters. And she was charged and convicted for that, you know, because they said, you know, like she was lying, you know, that that was not what she used the information for, and so on and so on. But her crime was, of course, not because she checked off the wrong checkbox. Her crime was looking into those Yuanlong attacks that were so sore, that was such like a painful thing for the Hong Kong public, and that made the government and the police look so bad. And so you have, you know, this really respected news organization with really respected programming and reporters, in the time span of like a few months to a year being completely transformed to one that is now, you know, basically at this point doing more propaganda than news. All my friends who used to work there have left because they don't feel that they can do, you know, actual reporting there anymore. The programs got butchered, right? The archives of those news programs oftentimes also die along with them. And so that's a piece of history that's gone then. The editorial guidelines have been immensely changed. And so that's a different story than Apple Daily, you know, like that, you know, like no longer exists. Spectacular death, you know, with the entire world watching. But what's relatively didn't get as much attention is this complete transformation of a really well-respected public service broadcaster to sort of, you know, this organization that now is amputated and degraded into doing, you know, things that don't really look like reporting anymore.
So as we near the tail end of our conversation, I'd like to discuss a couple quotes from public articles that you've given, or I should say been interviewed on. This is from The Guardian, who quoted you about the removal of Hong Kong University's Tiananmen Memorial statue, the Pillar of Shame. You say, "Everyone is aware that everyone else is watching, and nobody knows who will say what. You have the sense that people are watching. It's not like everyone is paranoid and super scared, but after the national security law, it has definitely increased." I'm wondering, for that quote, how is a Hong Kong that, you know, there were millions of people marching in the street fairly recently in the past few years, how do you think Hong Kong's everyday social relations will be transformed by this culture of censorship? And do you believe that should Hong Kong have a democratic future, that this can be undone? So what are people learning to internalize from censorship, and can they unlearn this in the future?
Well, what you see in Hong Kong right now is this sort of culture of repression, right, and self-censorship, you know, and this is not just a sort of a political top-down thing done by the government, but it's something we do to ourselves because, you know, we want to survive, we don't want to get into trouble. It's, you know, it's encouraged by family and friends who tell you to be safe and not say anything stupid. And it's also being done by bosses and employers, you know, because they look at social media and then they might fire you. You know, this has happened before, right? You know, people got laid off because of postings they had on social media. You know, even celebrities, you know, famous celebrities and sports stars, you know, have to sort of toe the line because otherwise they get canceled, you know, either in Hong Kong or in China or for the Chinese market. And as I mentioned before in the podcast, we really don't know what the red lines are, right? You know, a simple slogan like Hong Kong add oil could trigger someone or something, and so on and so on. And so we have yet to understand what the causes of this, what the business costs are, what the mental health costs are, how it will affect creativity and innovation, you know. And my concern is, you know, I'm saying this as a, you know, as in my role as a teacher, what I'm seeing right now is an entire generation of young people who is being taught that having dreams and ideals and hopes is something to be really dangerous and silly and stupid. you know, and an entire generation who aspires to make a difference with society, to do good and out of their own volition, that that's now being discouraged and being repressed. And so that's something that breaks my heart, you know. And so people are repressing, self-censoring, or leaving Hong Kong. And it's not just a loss of jobs. It's not just a brain drain. It's also this heart drain that's happening in Hong Kong. And that is really, really sad and tragic. And can we unlearn that? I hope so. You know, that is my hope, of course. You know, we are not born to repress ourselves. We're not born to self-censor ourselves. You know, like, to be human is to express yourself. You know, that's what makes us human. And so, you know, the Chinese government, you know, the Chinese regime, Beijing, will keep on hammering on the importance of stability and security and how it has improved the lives of people and so on, you know. But what makes us human is freedom, is, you know, like, what makes us human is our goal, our, you know, our aspiration to be our best selves, you know. And that's sort of the Hong Kong spirit, I think, too. You know, and it's not just sort of big words like democracy and truth and justice, but it's sort of how can we be ourselves and how can we be our best selves? And this is what is sort of so in against the idea, against what the Communist Party stands for, because they don't believe in the good of people. They only believe that, you know, like, people are dangerous. They need to be controlled and so on. And so the day that Hong Kong, you know, can allow people to be themselves again, you know, and to freely express themselves again, you know, I you know, like, I'm, and you might call me naive and optimistic for this, but I don't think that that will be so difficult. I mean, it will take some time to unlearn all the crap that we are now learning in order to survive, all the bad habits and so on, because, you know, like, we need that to survive. But in the end, you know, like, we're all better off if we end up encouraging young people to be their best selves.
So the Hong Kong protest movements were pluralistic. There were a lot of different tendencies, from liberal to left to conservative to nationalist. I'd like to use that as a framework to introduce your next quote for Global Voices, an article you were quoted on, or I'm sorry, you wrote this article actually for Global Voices, on the banal censorship of the PRC. You write, "As defined by American philosopher John Dewey, a public is a group of people who, in facing a similar problem, recognize it and organize themselves to address it." End quote of Mr. Dewey. You continue, "Instead, what the party wants you to think, this is not a public, this is a crowd. As understood by Gustave Le Bon, a crowd, in contrast to a public, is characterized by its," his quote, "impulsiveness, irritability, incapacity to reason, an absence of judgment of the critical spirit, the exaggeration of sentiments," end quote from Mr. Le Bon. You then continue, "The CCP propaganda narrative continues to portray the protesters as violent, irrational, emotional, and this picture does not fit the narrative." Now, in this article, you show this really interesting photo of just protesters standing around. And the crux of the article, part of it anyway, is trying to figure out why this would be censored. Now, as someone who lives in a country with a very conservative, oftentimes bordering on nationalist or even fascism, in the case of figures like Tucker Carlson, this seems like a one-to-one of what we would see from selective footage from, let's say, a Black Lives Matter protest, where you would only see, if you were watching a Fox News, protesters angrily confronting cops or screaming or yelling, acting like a crowd. You would very rarely see, similar to Hong Kong, the mutual aid efforts, the small moments of joy, the romances of youth. These sorts of things would be censored and not shown on a channel like Fox News. I'm wondering, could you discuss a little bit about how PRC state media has used banal censorship as a way to remove sympathy and solidarity between Hong Kong and the mainland during the height of these protests?
What the PRC, what Beijing has done really well, you know, to my regret, I guess, is to portray the protesters as violent, right, as rioters. And if you can do that successfully in the American media system, then imagine what it would look like if you had the power of the complete Chinese state media behind you, right, with all the censorship that they have and all the propaganda that they have. And so to frame a movement as something negative, as something chaotic, as something violent, is of course, you know, that's not necessarily typically a Chinese thing, you know, that governments have done that throughout the ages. But what makes the Chinese government so special is that they, you know, like the unique control they have to the media, to the point where even such a really sort of boring picture, right, of protesters just standing around can be censored, and someone feels it needs to be censored. And so it removes sort of all the links of solidarity and human connection that you otherwise would have. You know, like protesters are seen not as human beings, basically. That's the, you know, like, and I'm not saying that, you know, like there never should be censorship. You know, I can totally see that there's some content that's really, really harmful. But I wanted to highlight this particular photo because in this case, what exactly is the harm? Right, there literally is just a bunch of people standing around in a protest, sort of waiting, you know, because like there was literally nothing happening at that moment. And the harm, there is no harm except to the party talking points, right, where they want to portray the movement as violent and so on. And so it doesn't fit the propaganda narrative. And that is, you know, like inexcusable censorship. I don't know. It just makes it really sad that, you know, like we're at a point where pictures like that even have to be censored.
Do you want media that's still covering Hong Kong to be aware of the inverse of this, where I'm guilty of this? Oftentimes when I would put out podcasts in the past, I would choose a sensationalist image. One that comes to mind, I believe, I was speaking, I actually forget who, but it was the image of the woman in the red dress running through a shopping mall where there was blood on the ground. Other photos you often see are a Christmas tree on fire or the bridge face-off between police and protesters at Hong Kong Polytechnic University. Just as we need to be aware of benign censorship, cutting out these narratives of peace and joy and solidarity and just standing around, do we need to be aware if we continue to report on Hong Kong not being guilty of the inverse of only focusing on the sensationalist?
I think that's sort of the media and the news logic for you, right? You know, like, and how we have to play with that as protesters and as a movement, you know, like, and on the one hand, yes, I would say, you know, the answer is yes, we have to be careful and we have to be mindful about that. And some news outlets do it better than others, you know, like, and the way to do that is to give proper context and history and so on, you know, like that you use the image to draw attention, but then you lay out a bigger picture, right? And that you not just stick with that sensationalism. And on the other, you know, because at some level, you know, you have to accept that, you know, the human capacity for attention is just very, very limited, especially in this day and age where, you know, like we're being flooded with information all the time. And on the other hand, I think it's also really, really good if we can invest more time in stories that are not so junk food-ish, but that have a little bit more protein, a little bit more fiber, you know, and so on. And, you know, to be fair, you know, like, you know, I see efforts underway too, you know, maybe not in Hong Kong right now, because, you know, it's really hard to do that in Hong Kong, but, you know, in other places, I see efforts that, you know, I would love to see replicated elsewhere, where we do draw out, you know, sort of bigger picture things, you know. And so, because otherwise we do end up with this, you know, like idea of, you know, Hong Kong protests as violent, you know, because And, you know, and the government played beautifully into that, you know, like, because they know that every time there is this fire, you know, like the media will show that because it looks good, right? Because it draws attention and so on. And as a movement, you know, we just got to be smarter about that too. But in the end, you know, I think, you know, I can't put it into a number, but, you know, like a huge part of the movement was about the quiet moments, you know, like the solidarity, the acts of kindness, and so on, that, you know, that you mentioned and that I've experienced myself many, 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 many times over. And this sort of aspiration to do good and this belief in a better future, you know, and so on. And so, you know, it gets sort of, and this is why I say that the Hong Kong government and Beijing has done a good job in sort of drowning out that and instead flooding the media with, you know, this idea that the protests were violent, you know.
Well, Lachman, this was a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate you speaking on some of these issues. I think one of the most important things we can do to help Hong Kong is to continue reporting on it and having these intimate conversations about what the situation means for those who've had to leave, means for those who are still there. And as long as we keep talking, we don't forget. What can ordinary people do listening to this podcast do to help Hong Kong's fight for a free press? And why is it important, even if we're not from Hong Kong, to help in this fight?
That's a good question. Let me start with answering the last part of your question. You know, like, oh, why should people care even if they're not from Hong Kong, right? And the answer is sort of, you know, this is really not just about Hong Kong anymore. This is really about standing up to China, you know, and to Beijing and to the Communist Party. And Hong Kong has been the most visible in that regard, right? At the forefront, you know. But it's not just Hong Kong that have to do that. Everyone will eventually have to do that. And so you can look at the Olympics, right? And see, you know, like which governments and which athletes have been standing up to Beijing, right? You know, we've seen what happened to Peng Shuai, the tennis player. We've seen what happened to the NBA. We've seen what happened to the tech companies, you know, and this is not just a Hong Kong issue. And so, if you want to help Hong Kong, I think, you know, on the one hand, it seems sort of like, wow, you know, like, what can we do? Because, you know, how does anyone fight China at this point, right? Most government barely dare to call out China at this point anymore. I think what we forget sometimes is that the fight for freedom is not just a political one. It's sort of social and cultural too. And then so that might make it seem like really overwhelming, right? You say, am I saying, wow, it's not just political, you know, we have to change everything from social and cultural too. But what that means is that, you know, this fight for freedom is embedded in our everyday life. And so it's not just something that we do when we vote. It's not just something that we do when politics is going on. No, it's something that we do day in, day out, when we are teaching, when we are talking to our family, when we are working. And so that means it's also an opening. This is where we can start, where we can make a difference, you know. Personally, you know, when I was teaching, I try to teach according to the values I believe in. That means that I took my students serious. That means I encouraged my students to be their best selves. You know, that means I didn't tell my students what to think, but that I would ask them a lot of questions. You know, that means that I would support them if they wanted to do their own thing. And so if you share the same values that Hong Kong stands for, you know, what Hong Kong spirit stands for, you know, freedom, justice, democracy, believe in the good of people, then the best way to help Hong Kong is really to figure out how to live those values, how to practice those values in your daily life, you know, day by day, chat by chat, interaction by interaction. And that's how we change the world for the better. You know, like it doesn't have to be huge, you know, sort of like regime overthrow kind of like efforts, you know. We can make the world a better place, you know, according to the values by, you know, talk by talk and podcast by podcast, you know. How can we help Hong Kong? There's so many things we can do just by keeping your own house in order, for example. That would be so helpful. Because what we've seen also around the world is sort of this decline, right, of democracy and freedom. It's not just in Hong Kong. It seems to be at this point a worldwide phenomenon. And so together we're stronger. And what the authoritarian governments want us to do is isolate us and to divide and conquer. And so if you're stronger, you know, and you believe and you share the same values I have, you know, like if you're stronger, then we're stronger. And so that's, you know, what everyone should do and hope can do. You know, if you care about Hong Kong, then make sure you care for yourself too.
Lockman, thank you so much for your time today. Was there anything you wanted to mention as a media project or anything that you're working on that people can follow up on if they enjoyed our conversation today?
I would recommend people to follow my Twitter. It's twitter.com/LockmanTSUI, LockmanTSUI. I'm in Holland right now working on a personal book project where I try to reflect on everything that's happened to me as a teacher and as an activist in Hong Kong. And so, that's hopefully, you know, done in a year, if I'm optimistic. But yeah, I mean, meanwhile, you know, if you're interested, contact me on Twitter or on email. My email is lockmansui@protonmail.com. And let's chat.